Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on 4 continents but traveled to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives.
Valerie Whalen, formerly Valerie Oboke, is an explorer at heart, always open to what life may bring. She is a business owner, meditation facilitator, health and wellness coach, and a Reiki healer. She is Nigerian American and was born and raised in Inglewood, California. Currently residing in Perth, Western Australia, she founded Brown Girl Bloom in 2017. Brown Girl Bloom curates safe spaces for women of color to thrive with a focus on holistic well-being. She is also the co-founder of Ayun Hair, an ethical Southeast Asian human hair extension business that focuses on redefining the strands of beauty. Her passion lies in being in complete alignment with her truth, living a purposeful life, developing soul sister connections and community empowerment. She is an avid lover of all things spiritual and believes there is an abundance of beauty all around us. We simply need to open our hearts to truly experience it. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be involved in this podcast today.
I am, yeah, I'm so thrilled. We just kind of had a back conversation and like, we were born at the same hospital. This was meant to be.
Yes. That's, we have to be related.
So, okay. You're currently in Perth, Western Australia. How have you guys just been coping during this pandemic? What has been the Australian response?
Quite different from, I think, America, in this, there's a lot of, significant differences. I guess the first thing, that I would like to do is, just acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land that I'm meeting on today, the Whadjuk people of the United Nation, past and present, acknowledging that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So yeah, in Western Australia, the COVID response was, it was almost immediate. Probably, it could have started a little bit earlier, but probably as soon as they could address it. So they closed the borders around March of this year. And we didn't have as many cases as other areas in the world, like Europe and the US, simply because Western Australia is like extremely isolated, and Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world. So simply because of geographic location, we didn't have that real like a significant amount of like exposure to COVID. And so the local politicians, including like the prime minister, just made sure to really close the borders. Like even now in Western Australia, no one is allowed to enter Western Australia.
Like, good.
Good. And like, there's like this huge like uproar about it in other areas because there was just a spike in COVID cases in Melbourne, which is over east. It's near Sydney, because I know a lot of people know about Sydney. So they're not allowing anyone into the state. We don't have any community transmission, so everything's open. Everyone's kind of going to work and sort of living a normal life, but clearly I think that people need to prepare for like the true implications of like job loss and mental health trauma. It's going to come. So
yes, it really is. Like we're not even seeing like the real calamity yet, unfortunately. Right. Okay, so I mentioned in your bio, you're Nigerian American from Inglewood, California, and I'm from South Central, but I mentioned I was born at Sentinella Hospital as well. So when I learned about your backstory, I was that much more interested in interviewing somebody from the home turf. So I'm curious, what was your upbringing like early on? Did you experience any issues acclimating or assimilating amongst like African Americans? Because I mean, just to be fair, be like blatantly honest, like if you're like an 80s baby, which I'm assuming you may be, that was the African booty scratcher era, and that shit was prolific. So what was your experience like as, you know, really African American, like in the truest sense?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I actually shared with some friends here in Australia who they're all African. There's not many African Americans here in Western Australia. And I was saying how, you know, it's interesting, the dialogue and the narrative around being African is like now being celebrated. Whereas like when I was growing up, you know, 80s baby, definitely I was made fun of as being like a Nigerian kid. An African booty scratcher was like the main thing that people who look like me, were the ones calling me that, not people outside of my race. So that was really challenging. So I should just kind of give a little bit of backstory as you asked. My parents are Nigerian, so they migrated to the US in the, you know, in the 80s. And then they had my older brother and myself. And I really struggled with like this duality of having like, you know, real African parents, traditional African parents, and living in a Western world and trying to figure out like, where do I fit in within like this, you know, world where I don't really feel like I belong to any group in particular. Like I might not be African enough and I might not be Black enough because I'm African. So what I did is I suppressed my African identity. So my traditional name is Ekwutusi, which means to not judge others. And it's an Igbo name. So my people are from the Igbo tribe.
That explains your business acumen. Okay, I got it.
But I, at an early age, probably around like 6 or 7, I asked my mom if I could have a more American name. And she gave me, she allowed me to choose Valerie.
Wow, at 6?
Yeah.
Wow. So the teasing was like insipid and very, very early on then, if you made that request at 6. Wow. Well, yeah, I'm sorry. Really. You know, I have to apologize to another guest because, you know, I'm a Pan-Africanist. You know, I haven't lived in the United States in like 10 years. I live in Africa, but I was definitely one of those kids calling it, you know, the continental African children, African booty scratchers. And I feel so bad for that now as an adult. Yeah. So accept my apology on behalf of my people.
I understand it. I think when you take the time to reflect on like what were the roots of that that experience, it made sense, you know, the history
propaganda
around, right? Yeah. And you know, like with the, you know, slave trade right to America, you know, African Americans Africans who brought over to America were forced to eliminate like their heritage, their dialect, their culture, and conform to a Western way of living. So, you know, so I think that loss of identity was deeply rooted in, it's part of like the intergenerational trauma. And that's simply what I felt like was being mirrored. It was like, because of the loss of identity and like, where is home for me? It was like me being like this African kid who knew that my parents are from Nigeria. It was like kind of, you know, it was a difficult thing for people to deal with. So the best way to deal with things is to, you know, try to erase it. So them trying to belittle like my African heritage was a natural response. And so I don't hold any resentment because I know that it's just a journey to unpacking and unlearning and healing.
Well, that's a very mature That's very mature analysis. I'm glad you didn't come out like, man, I don't fuck with them. So good. Okay. All right.
No, not at all. I totally understand. I'm all good.
So, fast forwarding just a little bit. I believe you studied finance in college. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, I did.
Which I'm sure made your Nigerian parents very proud. And you had a career for a while within your industry. How did you make the quantum leap from corporate finance to a career as a professional basketball player in Australia?
Oh man. Yeah. It definitely involved disappointing my parents in an extreme way. If you have like African parents or migrant parents, you know, who move to a Western world for a better life, not just for themselves, but for their children, they're kind of in the state of survival. And so the decision to leave was one that I had to make on my own. I felt really lost in, you know, working in the corporate world and constantly trying to validate, you know, my parents' desires, like the ones that they could not attain themselves. That I had to be okay with letting that go to fulfill my own true desires, which was to find my truth. Who am I amongst all of this noise? Like, who am I? And I didn't know that. I thought that money would validate that or give me some form of self-worth, but it didn't. So when I quit my job, you know, and told my parents, I think they were more scared about the unknown than anything else, deep down inside. You know, your daughter is going to the other, you know, side of the world, and she doesn't have like a real plan, because basketball was just a means to creating a blank canvas for myself. So I'm not passionate about basketball, actually, but I had a mentor at the time who told me, you know, why don't you use your athleticism to see the world? And so that's kind of what I did. Now my parents are super, they're really proud because they realize that, you know, the 9-to-5 hustle,
goodness,
doesn't lead to much.
That's a whole other conversation. So I like that you, as you mentioned, you use athleticism as an entree into moving to Australia. I interviewed one of my homegirls, Daphne, just before our interview, and she lived in Australia, but she did it with that visa that young people can get when, I guess, if you're under 30, you could like get a work permit. So you did it as a basketball player. Like, did you play basketball in college? Like, how did you even hear about an opportunity to play basketball professionally in Australia? And as a, you know, as with a career in finance, like, how did that happen?
Oh my God. Miracles happen everywhere. it is a little bit random in ways, but I played college basketball. And I hated college basketball simply because it was so like controlling, and you know, we're constantly like, as beings, we're always like expanding. And I didn't like the fact that I had to conform so much to like one person's desires. You know, you'll probably hear that a lot in the way that I speak, is this desire to feel liberated. But when I got into the corporate world, I was like, yes, I don't have to play sport anymore. I could just make this money and, you know, like, you know, live, you know, like get the nice place, get the nice car and all these things. And when I was getting all those things, I still felt this like, you know, deep sense of emptiness. So I had a roommate at the time, and he was like, well, if you don't like what you do, like, well, why don't you find out what you like? Like, what do you like? And it was at that point that I realized I didn't even know what really brought me to fulfillment. You know, like that whole, okay, well, what now? Because I feel empty here, what now? So I took on, I do what most people do, right? We start trialing things and exploring. And I always say that it's trial and learning rather than trial and error, because I don't really believe that there's any real mistakes. It's just the opportunity to grow. Had two internships. And one of the internships, I was doing sports management for a basketball team in San Francisco. And the umpire, I had a chat with him. And as you can see, I like to talk. And I would tell him about, you know, my desire to find myself. And he seemed to really hear what I was saying. And so I asked if he could be my mentor. And he had all of these contacts in the basketball world in Australia. So he kind of linked me up with some teams.
Oh my goodness, how serendipitous.
Yeah,
you just never know how like one decision can just change the trajectory of your life.
Yeah,
forever.
So
what other things have you had any other professional situations in Australia where you've worked? Like, what's the contrast between like working in Australia and working in the United States? Because you mentioned like, you know, that 9-to-5 hustle, hustle, hustle mentality. Is it similar or radically different?
It's culturally quite different because Australians like enjoy their holidays and it's not like this hustle, 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 like lifestyle. Like I can only compare it to, you know, California. Here there's just a more ideal work-life balance. So, after I finished playing basketball, I worked in the not-for-profit and social enterprise sector because I'm all about living with purpose. And so I believe that all of our purposes lie within our community. So I was working in spaces where I was empowering young athletes who had a desire to move up the high-performance pathway. A lot of them played reached like state, national level, and some Olympic. So I helped.
Wow.
I ran like another not-for-profit that focused on lifelong learning. So for me, like the community sector brought more meaning to my life. And also I was able to kind of create my own schedule. So even like now I only work from home. I think in Australia, there's more.
Were you working for home long before the pandemic? Were you working from home long before the pandemic?
In some of my other roles, I was like a balance of working from home and at the center. But in this role, the job that I landed was solely working from home. And that was before the pandemic. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think you're married now, I believe, to an Australian man. What was your dating life before meeting your husband? And had you dated interracially before?
Yeah. So yes, I dated interracially before. Simply because I'm the type of person that I care more about like someone's personality and mm-hmm. what their passions are rather than their ethnicity or race.
Mm-hmm.
But dating in Australia is challenging. I have talked about this on my YouTube channel where I don't feel like Australia is that diverse, but people would beg to differ. So I guess I should maybe like edit that to say, like, if you're a Black woman, you're not going to see a lot of Black people around with the exception of like kind of small pockets here and there. I joined like dating apps because, you know, even back then, so that was 6 years ago, men were not like, you know, there was no courting or like approaching women like, hey, I'd like to get to know you. Can I have your number kind of thing?
Courtship is vastly different these days, I guess. Shit. Are you serious? That's so crazy. Is that like an Australian? Wait, that might be an Australian thing. Another lady that I interviewed, Sheila, was telling me like the concept of like they have a concept of like splitting the bill. Like, is it custom? Girl, where they do that? No.
That wasn't me, though.
She's like, let me qualify. That was not me, girl.
I don't do that. If you don't pay for the bill, we're not going to. Period.
But, no.
I went on dates like prior to my husband and it was like, I clearly noticed that it was this whole thing of like, we share responsibilities, but I kind of was like trying to counteract that with saying, you know, well, if you're asking me out, then you should be paying for things if you want
right.
to. That's just how
right.
I
Right.
The other issue is that, yeah, so on the dating app, it was predominantly white. And not that I had any problem with that, but it just seemed to be like kind of limited options if it's predominantly white. And also, it seemed like the white Australian men were not necessarily used to dating like Black women. Mm. So their responses were a bit weird sometimes. So, you know, like, hey, sister, and all this stuff.
Oh my God. No.
Yeah.
They got Aussie soul brothers, Aussie pseudo soul brothers. No. Bam.
Yeah, it wasn't cute. So so I always just kind of warn people about that. Just be prepared for like quite a few ignorant people. But there are really kind people out there as well. My husband was one of them. He's like a surfer. Also never dated, you know, like a Black woman ever. But he was more about, you know, like my energy and my spirit rather than like, oh, she's Black, so I wonder what she's going to be like, you know, that fetish.
Right. Yeah, those exist too. That's good. So thank you for being transparent about the dating. So okay, one of the inherent problems with leaving the United States is that, you know, as a Black woman, there becomes a dearth of options for places to get your hair done and to even find hair products, which is something that you've obviously encountered. And this frustration led you to founding an ethical hair extensions line. Can you tell us more about some of your hair experiences and your company?
Yeah, I would love to. So that's a really good point that you made, like the experience of a Black woman finding hair supplies around the world is always a daunting process because it's usually not necessarily catered for us unless you live in a predominantly Black area. Mm-hmm. And so here in Western Australia, you know, there's an African community here, but it's not like significantly large. So like we all know one another.
Right.
So there are hair salons. So there's not beauty supplies like in the U.S. So it's like a hair salon that sells some like beauty supplies, but not as good as like the ones back home. And I guess, so I'm natural. I've been natural since 2008. And I was wearing my natural hair out and then rocking braids. And then I wanted to wear extensions. And so I was sort of looking for brands that resonated with where I was at in my journey. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the brands were not in alignment with me. So I just decided not to purchase anything. And I ended up moving to Bali. And in my journey in Bali, it was like this real spiritual awakening of understanding that we're all interconnected. And when I realized that, I was like, okay, like I really want to support a product that empowers people rather than disempowering them and devaluing their worth. So I started INA Hair, where the hair strands are, we collect fallen hair strands. Yeah, so there's a bit of history around like the hair extension industry where women are actually forced into cutting their hair because when you live in a certain area where poverty is, you know, quite significant, people are gonna go to great lengths to make money. And so that means like literally forcing women to cut their hair off or offering them bread and water for their hair. And so they're not being paid for something that's worth a lot.
And that's crazy. I used to be in the hair industry as well. It's like 1,200 tons or something of hair that mm-hmm. is like, and you know, the ethically sourced part was always like, it was always a bit of a moral dilemma for me, if I'm to be perfectly honest. So I'm glad that you found like, you know, you found a way to like do social impact entrepreneurship around hair weaves, girl. I'm here for it.
I know it's so unconventional and unexpected, but I spent a lot of time in the villages. I am in love with Indonesian culture, in particular like Balinese Hindu culture as well. And in connecting with the women, I saw a great, wonderful opportunity to change the narrative within the beauty industry. And although it's like, how can you make, you know, hair extensions ethical? It's more about like encouraging people to be more mindful of how we consume things and how they impact other people.
Wow. So, okay, I mentioned you're so multidimensional. I mentioned also earlier in your bio that you're like, you're a Reiki practitioner, and then you just mentioned Bali. So I'm wondering, did you live in Bali to like become a meditation practitioner? What was your reason for living in Bali?
It's actually not, it has nothing to do with spirituality. you'll actually find that a lot of Australians go to Bali because it's like a, from WA. It's like but my husband is like a passionate surfer. And at the time, right before we moved, there was a lot of like, shark attacks, like with great whites. So I think just because he surfs like quite big waves, we felt like he would be more comfortable like in surfing in Bali because there weren't really that many in comparison to here. So that's literally like why we moved.
Oh my gosh, are you serious? That's one of the, I'm glad you mentioned this because this culturally, the way that we are oriented toward like the things that matter and life and work, it is so much different when you leave the United States. So just so I have this correct, you guys relocated from Australia because there were less great white sharks in, and this is a lifestyle sport that he has, or like he's a professional surfer?
Yeah, lifestyle.
Surfer.
No,
I
lifestyle.
I love that. There's hobby. Less great white sharks. Let's go to Bali. Got it.
Yeah, and
that's
it's like
white
it's
boy
funny.
Shit though, which I can appreciate. That is definitely some white boy shit.
It's true.
I love it. I love it.
I tell my husband this all the time, like the level of privilege, you know, to just be able to like something that simple be like the source of like wanting to move. Whereas like for me, I'm like, I want to find myself when, you know, move to the other side of the world. Yeah, it was the great whites, but also like Bali is really beautiful. You can have like a really lovely life on like a lot, you know, Australia is quite expensive in terms of like the cost of living. So Bali, if you can have Australian dollars and live in Bali, you're pretty good.
Right. Yeah. Geo arbitrage. I have to do like a whole separate show on that because that's like clutch if you're earning like high yielding currencies and living in a place where your current could triple or quadruple or even more than that sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of on a separate note. Since living in Australia, you have been a part of social justice projects as an Aboriginal community advocate. Why was this work so important for you to amplify the voices of the Aboriginal community there?
When I first moved here in 2012.
And to qualify, I'm sorry, they're Black.
Yes, they're Black. So Black in Australia.
Very clear. Yeah.
Black in Australia, it means like Aboriginal people call themselves Black, Black fellas. But also like African, those of African descent call themselves Black as well here in Australia, whereas it's just African American in the U.S. or I should say anyone who connects of African descent or maybe even Caribbean and things like that. I'm still learning, you know, like what Black means in the U.S. Because I had noticed someone said that they didn't want to be called African American. So anyways, when I first moved here in 2012, my first friends were Noongar women. So that there are hundreds of tribes, Aboriginal tribes in Australia. And in the southwest region of Western Australia, it's the Noongar tribe. And they opened me with welcome arms, you know, and they opened me. They welcomed me with open arms. and they treated me like a sister, you know. They... And through storytelling, listening to their journey and their stories, I found that we were deeply connected. Like our stories showed so many similarities. And I felt their pain. Like, I think when you can sit with someone and like really see the energy that they hold when they share the trauma of their people, you feel compelled to nurture and support amplifying their voices. So even before the Black Lives Matter protest, down south, I was working on mentoring young Aboriginal girls. A lot of them want to play basketball, so I was trying to support those ambitions. Even now, I work as like a health and wellness coach for Aboriginal women, and I help simplify the concept of healthy living by just showing easy ways of like incorporating healthier food into their lifestyles. I completely scrapped the idea, like this Western idea of having to weigh yourself and measure yourself. It's all about how you feel at the end of the day. So like even like the other week they tried quinoa for the first time and they were just like, what is that? Like, oh, this tastes really good. I've never had this before. So it's like those small experiences mean so much to me. Because, you know, in Western or in Australia in general, colonizers came over 200 years ago and they literally like just killed and raped and just pillaged,
like they do everywhere, child. It's only 22 countries in the world they didn't do it to, so
it's horrible. And you can still see the remnants of that impact now, because they had this stolen generation here in Australia where, you know, young kids, 5, 9, 10 years old, were taken from their homes and put into missionaries. And it was a policy where Europeans believe that if they could erase their identity and force them to become more Eurocentric, that they would have a better life. So children were snatched from their homes. And these people are still alive today. They're in their 50s and 60s. And so they remember being taken from their homes, being told that their parents didn't want them anymore, or that they weren't alive, until they completely forgot about their language and things, and then they were put back into society. And so you can see the impact of that trauma now.
Yes.
So knowing all
it's
that-
It's like copy things, and paste. It's like a copy and paste method. They just did that everywhere. To qualify though, because, you know, when people, unfortunately, you know, when people think of Australia, we think of a Western nation, right? And I mean, I guess in some ways it is, but we don't think of the original man. So phenotypically, like what does a typical Aboriginal, what is the appearance of an Aboriginal? What do they look like?
That's a good question. I've never had anyone ask me that before. I don't know if I feel comfortable describing them, because Aboriginal people come in all shapes, sizes, and colors, and like shades. And you also have Torres Strait Islanders who are also indigenous to this land, who are from like Queensland.
But they're very specifically like people of color, identifiably people of color. Yeah.
Well, you have, because of stolen generation, you have people who you may not be able to immediately tell that they are Aboriginal. So they're very fair. They might look like more Eurocentric, but they are definitely Aboriginal. So they're mixed. And that's a whole nother, you know, conversation, because colorism exists as well everywhere. And I don't think it's that any different here.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm always I believe in the kind of like, supporting people telling their own stories. So
right. I can appreciate.
I try not to go too far. I'd rather like an Aboriginal woman share her story and how she would describe her people than me describing them.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, my point was mostly because, you know, when we think of Australia, we don't think of Black folks and people of color. And so I'm glad that you're there and that you, even how you started the show. with, you know, paying homage to them. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, so I mean, there's some that could look like me, you know, We have, a lot of us have the same skin color as well. And some, like in up north, I remember I met some Aboriginal men. I mean, they literally reminded me of some of my Nigerian relatives, like with the raspy voice and the structure of their face and their skin color. Yeah.
How did they get there? I mean, I guess we're everywhere, but I mean, you know what? Everywhere you go, I mean, everywhere we go, there we are. It's every time, like, there's like unearthings of, I think one of the things that's not popular and people don't understand is that Black people circumnavigated the globe long before white men knew how to make a boat. and it's evidence of that, you know, still in some of the, you know, indigenous communities all over the world. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest lesson that you have learned about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
I think the biggest lesson I've learned is to flow with what is rather than trying to control the process. So allowing life to unfold as it should and trusting it. I think that, like, for me, what I know is that when I came here, you know, you have all these expectations and desires and you want them to happen a certain way. Like, I think we tend to romanticize things because of, like, especially like when you're in America, you're like, oh, it would be so much better somewhere else. But challenges come in all shapes and sizes
everywhere.
Anywhere we go.
Yeah.
And it won't change because you leave America.
Do you know sugar-free?
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't hide from yourself because everywhere you go, there you are.
So true. You can't hide from yourself, and you can't run from your truth and the things that you have to unlearn. So that's what I mean by just flowing, because when I came here, there were still challenges I had to face. There were still like past traumatic experiences that I had to let go of. And liberate myself from. So it was, for me, like this journey abroad has been much more of like an internal journey of unpacking and learning than an external one.
And what year did you leave?
2012.
Okay, so it's been 8 years, great. So what advice do you have for Black women that are thinking of, you know, potentially making the leap?
The best advice I would have is, I feel like I'm sort of repeating myself now, but is to embrace the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Embrace what the journey will look like and start where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we put a lot of emphasis into like getting ready to leave and start something, and it's like, it's never going to feel right. So you might as well just start where you're at.
It's so true. I mean, there has to be some level of preparation, but it's so true. I think I made the decision like 6 or 7 weeks before I was going to do it. And I just did it.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there should be some level of preparation, like financially having some kind of padding or something. But you know what, when you become intentional, and I think people do when they leave, things kind of unfold in beautiful ways. So it always works out the way that it's supposed to.
Yeah, that. So what's next for Valerie, and where can people keep up with your journey on social media?
Yeah, so what's next for me is that I'm putting a lot of energy into Brown Girl Bloom, which is a safe space for women of color to heal, thrive, and bloom collectively. So that looks like guided meditations, collective conversations. I'm working with I'm working on creating a documentary to explore the journey of healing, because it's not an overnight process. It's not. And so that's kind of like, that is like my greatest passion. So I love using that space to serve my community. So that's what's next for me. And where people can find me is on Instagram, Brown Belle Abroad. Belle is B-E-L-L-E. And all of my other links are on there.
Excellent. I'm glad that you mentioned guided meditation, because I've always felt like something that's missing in the market. Like, I love guided meditations. I don't want to hear no man's voice. I don't want to hear no white man's voice. I don't want to hear no Indian man's voice. I definitely don't want to hear no white bitch voice guiding me along a guided meditation. So I am thrilled that there's going to be a Black voice for guided meditations. That is definitely something that's missing in the market. For sure. It's been such a pleasure interviewing you. I haven't met you in person, but I feel that you're a kindred spirit, and I'm happy to have had this opportunity.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoy, you know, sharing my story. And I should say that I've been listening to your other episodes, and they're so good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's beautiful to hear the stories of other Black women, because it just gives so much hope and just inspiration to all of us.
And we out here everywhere.
Shout out to our Patreon members for your support. If you too are interested in joining the Black Broads Abroad movement, you can follow us on social media, and that's BLACKBROADS. That's on Instagram and Facebook. And if you'd like to become a supporter on Patreon, you can do so on patreon.com/blackbroadsabroad.